And welcome to another edition of the Odyssey Radio Program. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. We talk about ancient and modern mysteries across the globe. And tonight's topic is all about those ancient mysterious monuments that are still to be found all over the world. And I've invited an expert on the subject. He's written many books on lost civilizations. His name is David Hatcher Childress, and his latest book is titled The Mystery of the Olmecs. Welcome to the show, David Hatcher Childress.
Hi, Mike. Good to be on your show.
Thank you so much. I know you travel all across the globe, and I want to start out over in Malaysia, of all places, since we got to start somewhere, okay?
Okay.
There's a very weird ancient site. It's 92 artificial islands. It's a place called Nan Madal, kind of like a long-lost city. Why don't you describe what it looks like for the listeners and tell us about it?
Yeah, right. That is in Micronesia, which is near to Guam and Palau, Saipan. It's the some of the battles of World War II. Truk Island is also nearby there. And on the island of Ponape there is what I call the eighth wonder of the world, and that is Nan Madal. And Nan Madal is, it's 250 million tons of basalt stacked up in a almost 100 artificial islands. Nan Madal isn't even built on the island of Ponape. It's built into the ocean. It defies explanation in many cases. Entire mountains would have been dismantled to build this city. And they don't know, you know, who built it, how they built it, why. The natives on the island claim that the stones were levitated, flown across the island. Many of the stones weigh 20, 30 tons. The heaviest basalt boulders there they found so far weigh 50 tons, and that they were flown magically through the air and then stacked up in these artificial islands, these walls, sometimes 20 feet, 30 feet high, and much of the city's underwater as well. And in my books, like Lost Cities of Ancient Lemuria in the Pacific, we go, one of the chapters, we go scuba diving there, into this underwater city, although most of the city is above water.
Right. Now, if they were to stack a 50-ton stone onto one of their primitive boats, wouldn't it just sink the boat? I mean, that's...
Well, you would think so. That's right. And in fact, you will occasionally see this city on Discovery Channel or something like that, although curiously is not featured in many of these documentaries. But in one, they try and do that, where they get one of these big basalt logs. It's weighing only a few tons, you know, say 4,000 pounds or something like that. And even I think the stone isn't that big. And they have difficulty to carrying it. But that is what, you know, mainstream archaeologists are saying, that that the city is only, say, 500 years old, that it was built shortly before Europeans, Spanish discovered these islands. Became discovered at the same time as the Spanish also explored the Philippines and areas like that.
Right.
But, you know, how they could have built it is still unexplained, and even why. I mean, it's huge. It's gigantic.
It's giant.
You can't believe it until you're there.
Yeah, I interviewed Frank Joseph, and he said it didn't look like it was really habitable with no windows and doors. He thinks it's some kind of energy generator. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, people have speculated, even from early on, that it's some kind of interdimensional window, stargate kind of thing. There is energy phenomena there. In my book, Anti-Gravity and the World Grid, I talk about grid spots and power places. Ponape is one of them. Bruce Cathy, the New Zealand pilot and mathematician who writes these books about the energy grid, and the Bridge to Infinity, and then Harmonic Conquest of Space. He also says that Ponape is a special place on the Earth. And the city is built basically out of magnetized crystals. Basalt crystals are these Lincoln log, hexagonal crystals. They cool from lava. They're extremely heavy. And they're magnetic. So, that's one way that they would have levitated these stones, too, is because of the magnetism there. They were probably able to, through various means, levitate the stones and then move them into place. whether the city was habited, I think it was ultimately myself, and I would disagree with Frank Joseph there.
Okay.
I would say that it was a gigantic naval base. And that's one of the first things that that you see when you come into Namadol. It is giant islands built around what is also apparently an artificial reef. And I say in my book, Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of Lemuria in the Pacific, that there are two cities there. One is an ancient city from like Mu or Lemuria, and it's over 10,000 years for sure. And it has coral growing over it. Now, a second city was placed on top of it with all of these giant basalt blocks. That city was apparently part of a giant naval base that ultimately settled much of the Pacific, including Tonga, the Marquesas, even part of the mystery of Easter Island, you know, comes into play with this giant city, which is in Micronesia.
Fascinating. Let's move over to Brazil now and talk about the Chronicles of Akakor. This is such an obscure story, I can't even find info on the internet, okay, on this story. But apparently it starts with a journalist in 1972 in Brazil. He talked to an Indian about UFOs and ancient gods. Tell us about this story.
Well, the Chronicle of Akakor is discussed as a chapter in my book, Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of South America. And in there, I tell the story of Tutankhamun. He's a real person. Several of my friends have met him, although I have not personally ever met him. He was Jacques Cousteau's guide on the Amazon. And if you watch the old Jacques Cousteau special of him on the Amazon, you will see this guide, Tutankhamun, in it. There's a coffee table book of that, too, and he's also mentioned in it. He was the chief of the Ugalala Mongala tribe, and he was part German, part Amazonian Indian. And he claimed that, his tribe was partially lived in this underground ancient city that was near the border of Brazil and Peru. He maintained that there was also this ancient history of like secret records, a little bit like the Edgar Casey Hall of Records or some kind of, you know, secret gold library or something. And his book, there was a book that was published in Germany too in the mid-70s by a German journalist who tried to go to this underground city. His name was Hermann Brugger. Brugger, later, they couldn't make it all the way to the city, so that part was never proven. Tutankhamun is a real guy. Brugger was later murdered in Rio de Janeiro.
Really?
And, and that was a famous story, too, in the mid-80s. And at the time, his murder was quite well-known and was featured in all the newspapers and magazines and stuff in Brazil. And Brugger, who was a German, but he lived in Brazil, and reported on a lot of oddball subjects and even just normal things as well. But one day he was walking in the streets and a guy came up to him asking me if he was Hermann Brugger, who had written about this lost city and had to do also a little bit with Germans in South America, weird stuff like that, and U-boats going up. A bunch of Germans supposedly went to this lost city. It all gets pretty bizarre.
The Nazis, correct?
Nazis, and that he himself was, part German and part American Indian. And it went back to World War II. And in the book, too, in my book, Lost Cities, Ancient Mysteries of South America, I mean, we talk about that, how Germany had U-boats going up there during the time. And in a lot of my books, including Fantastic Inventions and Nikola Tesla and my book that did with Renato Vesco on man-made UFOs, we talk a lot about these secret cities in South America, also the idea of UFOs coming from some of these cities, one being associated with Marconi and him disappearing in the mid-1930s and he and a bunch of scientists going there. You get a lot of strange stories. I also write about tunnel systems going through the Andes in Peru, Bolivia, Chile, Ecuador. You have this City 2, supposedly, of Tutankhamun's was underground. So you get into a lot of weird stories there. All my books on lost cities get into weird ancient tunnels, cities underground, Mount Shasta kind
Absolutely.
Of stuff.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of Shasta, let's go there next. You tell some stories about possibly Lemurians and a lot of UFO sightings and some even townspeople up in Shasta who have perhaps seen them. Talk about that for a bit.
Well, you know, Mount Shasta was early on in the late 1800s. A number of curious books were published, including a book called The Dweller on Two Planets by this guy, Philos the Tibetan. This is a book that came out in, like, 1890, and it talked about Mount Shasta having tunnels and that these ancient masters lived in there, and like Atlanteans and Lemurians and stuff. Also, it talked about Vimanas, these ancient craft that were in Atlantis and ancient India and stuff like that. That's also one of my books, Vimana Aircraft of Ancient India and Atlantis, where I go into these ancient texts to talk about these things. These ancient aircraft that are these airships that were developed thousands of years ago, supposedly. And Mount Shasta is associated with those in that there would be a hollow mountain there, kind of like the Cheyenne Mountain that's in Colorado.
Right, and Mount Shasta is in Northern California, by the way, for those not familiar. And you tell a story in your book about some tall beings who walk into a little store and they give them a hunk of gold and just walk off with some goods.
That's right. Around Mount Shasta, and you know, and in Northern California area, for say the last 100 years, stories of mysterious people living inside Mount Shasta. There's many lava tubes and things like that. UFOs are often seen around there. So, I mean, you have stories of, yeah, these kind of mysterious people. They're humans, they're a little bit different from the month, sometimes taller, dressed a little bit strange, and they all have gold, and they would come in and they would trade gold and things like that. I mean, entire mythology has developed there, but in my mind, you know, there really is something to much of this stuff, and I look at history differently, and it, not everything that's strange is true, but there seems to be a thread of truth in a lot of this, and I think with Mount Shasta, you have to think, too, of how it would seem normal to go underground and in the face of ancient catastrophes, even everything from volcanic upheavals and tidal waves to wars and things like that. To go underground is a fairly safe area, and in fact, our own military is doing that today. So in my books, I'm often arguing that unlike what, you know, the mainstream is saying that, you know, everyone was a caveman 20,000 years ago, and you draw this straight line on the graph from caveman up to modern man, and there you go, and we're modern. But you know, the Atlantis theorists like myself are saying, yeah, that history is this roller coaster of ups and downs and ages of enlightenment and science, just like today, coupled with cataclysms and going back to the Stonehenge, the Stone Age. And so Mount Shasta fits in with that, too, where you have some scenario. I maintain that, you know, there wasn't really the consumer society that we have today, but in ancient times, you know, people had. They had electricity. They had air machines and stuff like that, airships. One of my most popular books recently has been my book, Technology of the Gods. And in that book, I show how ancient Egyptian temples and electricity, even heavy machinery, were known to the ancient peoples. And ultimately, yeah, they made airships. But I don't feel that ever was there quite a society that we have today with television, all the consumer things and stuff like that.
But they did have electricity. That's fascinating. You mentioned underground cities a couple of times. Why don't we get to that subject now? I know in India there's a staircase. People can go down to these giant doors, and they talk about the Nagas, the serpent people. Is this all legend, or have you found some fact to these stories?
Well, you know, it's hard to see those things in India. Many of the Hindu temples and things like that are are guarded. You can't go there. Kind of similar to Mecca or something. Like, yeah, if you're not, you know, part of their special thing, they won't let you into these places. India is so important because the knowledge and history and libraries have been destroyed and purposely destroyed throughout history. Everything from the library at Alexandria to the Emperor Qi Wang Ti of China ordering every book in China destroyed in 500 BC. Reading Egyptian hieroglyphs, trying to read all these dead languages. But India is important because India still has, more than any other country, a direct link back to these ancient books, back to their own history. Being able to read archaic Sanskrit and stuff like that. And it's a history that reads like the wildest science fiction. So the idea of places where you have hidden doors into the earth, Mount Kailash, which in Tibet, which is also sacred to Hindus and Buddhists alike. When you see Mount Kailash, it looks like this giant stone pyramid. And it looks like the Great Pyramid coming up out of Tibet. It's the most sacred place probably in the world. And you wonder, it has a swastika on one side of it.
Wow.
And when you see it, it's like it almost out of a Buck Rogers thing. I mean, it's like a Mount Shasta or a Mount Cheyenne where the ancient Atlanteans or whatever, you know, could have put doors into this mountain and go inside. Throughout Tibet and India, Mongolia, you have these stories of Shambhala, Shangri-La. This, in my book, Lost Cities of China, Central Asia, and India, I talk about the land of Si Wang Mu. And it, too, is out in northern Tibet, in the Kung Lung Mountains there. And it's exactly like what you're talking about. Doors going into a mountain. And, you know, ancient travelers would meet these immortals and stuff like that. And the same kind of stories that are associated with Mount Shasta.
Absolutely. I want to remind our listeners, I'm talking to David Hatcher Childress. He's written many, many books on the topic of lost civilizations. Back to Central America, I know that you traveled there and you found many statues that had Egyptian headdresses, and what do you make of that?
Well, right, and that's also in my new book, The Mystery of the Olmecs. Mm-hmm. And much of what was going on in ancient Central America and ancient South America has to do with the ancient Egyptians, transatlantic and trans-Pacific trades, ancient China, the Olmecs are part of this, and today they know that virtually everything that was attributed to the Mayans is now really, was originated by the Olmecs. But who were the Olmecs? This very mysterious people, they don't look like the Mayans. Many of the Olmecs look very African. They wear these weird leather helmets. I mean, they really look like some Nigerian rugby players or something like that.
Why don't you talk about what the Olmec heads are?
Yeah, the Olmec heads, you have these giant, colossal heads, and that's what they're called by archaeologists. They weigh up to 20 tons. They're also carved out of basalt, like at Nan Madol. And that city we were talking about earlier that's on this remote island in Micronesia, built out of the ocean, it has 250 million tons of these basalt crystals are used. The Olmecs also used these basalt crystals, and they built their tombs out of it. And they would carve these giant, colossal heads, and they look very African. There's pictures, of course, in my book.
And Asian, too. Right?
Yeah, and many of them look very Chinese. They had also the elongated skulls of the deformed cranium, and I discuss that quite a bit in the book, why they were elongating these skulls. Others also had very heavy mustaches and beards. They looked like they were Phoenicians or something. Many Olmecs also wore the false beard, which was a very Egyptian thing of having a beard that was just tied to you. American Indians, by the way, and such as the Mayans, were not able to grow beards or mustaches. They don't really have facial hair. But many of the Olmecs have exactly that, thick mustaches, thick beards. and clearly look foreign. They look African in many cases. In other cases, though, they don't look African. They look very Chinese. And in fact, I mean, ultimately, in the end, as they tried to make sense of the whole Olmec area, and they tried to find the origins of Olmec writing, which is some of the earliest scripts, and the Olmecs go back to at least 1300 BC. And what they found was that the earliest of all the Chinese hieroglyphs, which are the Shang Chinese hieroglyphs, and this is the very beginning of Chinese writing, also is the same as the earliest Olmec hieroglyphs.
Uh-huh. Now, I'm looking at pictures in your book of the giant skulls that were found in this area, and they look to me like UFO or ETs.
That's right. You look at these giant, weird craniums. I mean, they are the cone heads.
Yeah.
Back in the 80s, there was on Saturday Night Live, there was a skit that ultimately it was a movie of it, the cone head.
That's the shape, yeah.
And people did that. It was a common thing. They do look like extraterrestrials. And some of these guys had really, really extended craniums. They look like extraterrestrials. They're not the kind of guys you want to run into in a dark alley or something. But here's the thing, is that this was very common. And now why people did this, we don't know. Maybe some of them were extraterrestrials. Some were definitely humans. And there is a way to make these skulls. And why they were doing it, we don't know. Maybe they were trying to imitate extraterrestrials who looked like this. You would also double your brain capacity when you did stuff like this. And, your head would be twice as big. The Flathead Indians did this. People in the Congo, the Kurds of northern Iraq. Akhenaten and Nefertiti did that. Tutankhamun, who so famous, and his mummy and all that. He also has one of these elongated skulls. But it was extremely popular in South America, and the Olmecs are very well known for it. It was done on remote Pacific islands. And in fact, the whole idea of cranial deformation lends a lot of credence to the idea that the Olmecs and Central America were kind of Panama Canal of the ancient times, where ships were coming across the Pacific, and they were going to Easter Island. They were going to this place in Amidal, the Marquesas, Tahiti, Tonga, where also you have all these megalithic pyramids and megalithic arches. All through the Pacific are giant, huge statues, walls. Easter Island is so famous for that. But there are many of these islands, and including Micronesia. And these people were traveling completely across the Pacific, and there was contact between ancient India, ancient Egypt as well, China, out to all these islands, and to Peru and the Pacific coast of Mexico, even California and areas like that. And there was also this transatlantic trade as well. People, see, in countries like Egypt and also the Olmec area of Olmec of southern Mexico, these countries, if you want to call them countries, they had ports on two oceans. They could have, the Olmecs had ports on both the Pacific and the Atlantic, and the Egyptian had a similar thing, where they had ports on the Mediterranean, and they also had ports on the Red Sea, which allowed them to go to India and then to Indonesia and then across the Pacific.
I see. Now, in one of your books, you write about a museum you go to in Guatemala, and there's all of these statues, and they're half dragon and half human. And we see this all around the world, of course, the Sphinx of Egypt. And what do you make of these animal-human hybrid statues? Are they trying to symbolize real creatures, or is this mythology? What is this?
Well, you know, I mean, it could be both. In my book, The Mystery of the Olmecs, I have a whole chapter about that, and particularly the Olmec predilection for what they called were-jaguars. And this is a similar thing. The Navajos in northern Arizona, New Mexico, also have this thing called skinwalkers. But it's this whole thing of, becoming an animal. For the Olmecs, it was a dragon in some cases or a jaguar. And even they went through apparently certain disfigurements and tattooing and things like that to actually look like jaguars or dragons and things like that. I mean, the whole idea of genetic manipulation this way, that's a fascinating idea. And it's probably in Atlantean times and other times like that in ancient India where they were doing very high-tech stuff, there was genetic experimentation going on. One of the things that Edgar Cayce talks about, which is pretty interesting, and I've always been interested in his stuff, is that in Egypt, in Atlantean times, they had special temples, and they were to actually remove tails from people, where people were still human beings, still kind of acting and looking like animals, being very hairy. It's a known thing that some people are still born with tails, but that in ancient times this was more common, where they were trying to civilize people, surgically remove tails from them.
Amazing.
You have all the stories of Sasquatch, Wildman, the whole thing of Neanderthals.
Right. Well, there's one theory that the Anunnaki, if you believe in them, wiped out a lot of this genetic mutation by the flood, the Great Flood, and kind of started over. What do you think of that?
Well, something like that happened, and people definitely were giants in ancient times.
We know that.
Right. Now, whether they were like centaurs or minotaurs, where people actually had the heads, and you know, you hear that, sometimes you hear about aliens like this, too, where they have... Mm-hmm. Somehow the head of an animal, but a human body, which is kind of how you think of genetic mutation, maybe your Island of Dr. Moreau. But more, I would say that, there's a mythological element, and, I mean, it's kind of curious, the whole thing of people turning into animals and going into, like, this sort of werewolf thing. But people were different in ancient times, and they were giants. That's certain. And they had these long craniums. People were, I believe, more commonly 7-8 feet tall, even taller than that.
Of course,
they often
Goliath.
Had six fingers. There were a lot of kind of mutants in that way, for sure. I'm more of a believer, personally, in ancient civilizations on Earth. I do believe there are extraterrestrials. I believe that things are happening that way. I do know Zachariah Sitchin and familiar with his work, and I'm fascinated by it, but I'm more of a person who believes in Atlantis, ancient civilizations on this planet, and that most of, you know, like say Atlantis and these civilizations weren't really built by extraterrestrials, but by human beings, just like us, although they were in many cases 8-9 feet tall.
Right. That's an interesting theory. In Central America, a few more things. There's a really interesting building called El Caracol, which means the snail, I believe, and it's like a circular observatory. Why don't you talk about that building a bit?
Well, right. That's in Chichen Itza and the Yucatan. And, in fact, that was probably a Phoenician building. Throughout, you know, the world, the ancients have made many of their pyramids, monuments, the Caracol in Chichen Itza is also like this. They're astronomical tools, and they've now proven that Stonehenge in England is a eclipse computer that's predicting the 19-year moon eclipse cycle. The ancients were utterly obsessed with the stars, with eclipses, with the movement. This gets into, on a real basic level, just navigation, getting the equinox and things like that. The whole idea, too, of the Mayans having their calendars so perfectly attuned, but it's tuned itself to a different cosmic cycle. They were, in many ways, obsessed in this, but we don't know exactly why. It could have to do with cataclysms that they're trying to predict, pole shifts. I'm myself a believer, and this is largely what I propound in my books on lost cities and ancient mysteries, is that there have been a number of cataclysms that have occurred. There's been a number of civilizations that have been before ours. There are these periodic times of geological upheaval. Volcanoes all go berserk. There's a magnetic pole shift. The magnetic field of the Earth reverses. The Earth itself actually lurches forward on the crust. This is what Hapgood and stuff call crustal slippage. This, of course, causes volcanoes all over the world to go off. There's giant tidal waves, tsunamis race over entire continents. I mean, it's heavy, heavy duty. There's extinctions because of tectonic plate technology. Whole continents will rise up or down. This causes more earthquakes and things like that. I mean, it is devastating, and we haven't gone through this for thousands of years. I mean, even the last few hundred years, we have been relatively free of the really devastating just normal activity that would go on. I mean,
absolutely.
There would normally be a lot more volcanoes going off, even tsunamis. And people believe, and I'm one of them, that we are coming up to a period where there's going to be more of this, and that it does ultimately culminate in a totally devastating event. And perhaps this is being predicted by, say, the Mayans with the end of their calendar in 2012.
It may be. So let's talk a little bit about Egyptian society. They certainly believed in polytheism and Osiris and Ra and all of these gods. Do you think this was another group of beings or kind of mythology?
Well, they had the Neter, and that was the nine gods of ancient Egypt. You know, you go back also to ancient Hinduism, where you have a trinity there of Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahman. Within Egyptian society, it was the nine gods of the Neter. You have stories like that of the Council of Nine. One thing I'm familiar with of that is this, if you go into the Uri Geller kind of stuff where he and Andrea Puharic talked about this, this was also discussed in the book The Stargate Conspiracy, where this Council of Nine, who are associated with this Egyptian Neter that you're talking about, are part of this, like, Star Trek council that's on one of the moons of Saturn. And yeah, they are these space brothers, they're helping. In that whole scenario, they're helping to guide the Earth into some new golden age. And, you know, part of the problem with planet Earth is that we're violent and trying to kill each other all the time, and they're trying to stop us. This is quite different than the Zachariah Sitchin thing of the Anunnaki, where he's got this planet way, way out in space. They're not constantly monitoring the Earth. They come back every 300,000 years or something like that. It's kind of a whole different story.
Yeah, it's definitely a different philosophy.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm quite familiar with that, and I enjoy his books. I've read them all. I'm more of, and one of my books is a book called Extraterrestrial Archaeology. Mm-hmm. And that book is all about how there are pyramids on the moon, there are domes on the moon, there are machines moving around on the moon, there are UFOs on the moon. I talk about Mars and the moons of Mars and other planets, too, in that book. The book is full of illustrations, so you can see that book and all of my books on our webpages at adventuresunlimitedpress.com. And that book, I mean, what I largely say in that book, Extraterrestrial Archaeology, is that the moon is occupied, and it's occupied right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the moon itself is a space base. I mean, there's something special about the moon. NASA says the moon is older than the Earth. The whole idea that the moon was captured, it's more like something like that, like it's an extra terrestrial body that's been specially placed in an orbit around our planet. It's quite different than all the other moons. Our moon stays in a special orbit around our planet that's unusual.
It certainly is unique, and I apologize for jumping all over the map, but I did want to get to many different subjects. So I want to ask you about the crystal skulls. There were these said to have magical powers. There was one found in Central America that was very famous. Why don't you talk about the crystal skulls?
You know, the whole idea of these ancient crystal skulls being placed around the planet, there some crystal skulls have already been discovered. The famous one that I talk about in my book, Lost Cities of North and Central America, is the Mitchell Hedges skull. And that is a two-piece, life-size crystal skull with a movable jaw. And in fact, it's carved out of one piece of crystal. That crystal skull was studied by IBM for years. And IBM's top crystallographer, a guy named Marcel Vogel, kept it actually in an IBM lab and for years studied it and ultimately made some reports. There's several books on it. It was owned by this explorer, Indiana Jones guy, whose name was Mike Mitchell Hedges. He discovered this lost city called Lubantin in Belize. And inside this city with his adopted daughter, her name was Sammy, they discovered this crystal skull. And at one point it was sold to the British Museum, then it was bought back by him. There's another crystal skull that's kept at the British Museum. Crystal skulls are found largely in Central America and Tibet, which is curious. You have another interesting correlation between ancient Mexico and Tibet and China, which is the whole jade fascination. And with both the Mayans and the Olmecs, and the ancient Chinese and Tibetans, jade was the most valuable thing. And they valued that the most. Other things they also valued were psychedelic mushrooms, exotic feathers, and also these crystal skulls.
Interesting. There's also another very mystical city called Uxmal in Central America, and they have this Temple of the Magician. Why don't you talk about this series of buildings and what you think their purpose is?
Well, you know, much of what you have in the Yucatan, including the Temple of the Magician at Uxmal, the Caracol at Chichen Itza, Tulum, Lubantin is also in this area. They say there's over 100,000 lost pyramids still in the Petén jungles.
Wow.
of Yucatan and northern Guatemala. You go into Tikal. Those areas, too, much of that was originally Mayan, and particularly in the central jungles of the Petén, which is right where the northern Guatemala and the Mexico, Quintana Roo and Yucatan all meet. I mean, it's a huge, vast area, completely depopulated. Even today, no one lives in that area. They've used satellite photos and infrared looking at these massive canals going all through there. That area is going back ultimately to the Olmecs. And now they're realizing that the oldest Mayan cities were ultimately originally begun by the Olmecs. And this is also what I say in my new book, The Mystery of the Olmecs. But now some of these cities, like Chichen Itza, the Uxmal,
sure,
these cities became later conquered by the Toltecs. And the Toltecs were a later group who preceded the Aztecs. But they ruled from an area of northern Mexico, an area called Tula. And that also has a lot to do with Arizona, some of the mysterious lost cities and ruins that are in Utah, Nevada, California as well. Mount Shasta possibly is connected to all that. The Zuni Pueblo and the Hopis. This, in my book on lost cities in North and Central America, I talk about the Egyptian city that was found in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, that's a bombshell you uncovered, and you even found a newspaper article describing an Egyptian tomb inside the Grand Canyon?
That's right. In my book on lost cities in North and Central America, I have a whole chapter on the Egyptians in Arizona, how in 1909 the Phoenix Gazette reported on the front page how the Smithsonian Institution and these early explorers were excavating these incredible caverns, man-made caves in the Grand Canyon. And inside these caves were all of these mummies and statues, swords and shields, other artifacts. According to them, they were saying that the Smithsonian, and they name the archaeologist and who's part of it, he's saying that these artifacts are from ancient India and from ancient Egypt. It's like a Tutankhamun's tomb, like in the Valley of the Kings. And in fact, it fits right into much of the ancient Egyptian burial practices, what they were talking about, because no Egyptian mummy was ever found in a pyramid in Egypt. I mean, even though we're taught that pyramids,
which
pyramids are all over the world, but no Egyptian mummy Mayan mummies and other mummies have been found in pyramids, and some Ptolemaic Greek mummies have been found in Egyptian pyramids, but no Egyptian mummies was ever found in a pyramid in Egypt. But yet they found hundreds, thousands of mummies in Egypt, but they weren't in pyramids. They were in these caves, these vaults, caught into canyons, exactly like the Grand Canyon, in these deserts, like the Valley of the Kings, this is where Tutankhamun was found, the Valley of the Queens, places like that. And, I mean, they're like out of an Indiana Jones movie, and that's what they were saying was in the Grand Canyon, where these vaults are cut into solid rock, you have false doors, you even have pits going down and trap doors. In ancient Egypt, they put poisonous gases and things like that inside these tombs.
Oh, wow. So, to this day, there's maps of the Grand Canyon with, like, the Temple of Isis and Osiris on the maps, and that's the location, correct?
Well, that's right, and the more and more I've researched it, and my new book, which will be coming out soon, is a book called Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest, and I go into much more detail about this amazing Egyptian city in the Grand Canyon. And as you look into the whole Zuni and Hopi things, there was a guy in the late 1800s, his name was Seth Tanner. Some of the trails in the Grand Canyon are named after him. And he was blinded by the Hopi Indians in about 1890 because he had seen this secret canyon and this secret caves in Grand Canyon. This is before the Phoenix Gazette story in 1909. But he was, because he had seen this special thing, they blinded him, and there are still photos.
That's, you know, more confirmation.
The old 60s cowboy movie with Gregory Peck and Omar Sharif, a movie called McKenna's Gold, is largely about that.
Wow.
And it's about, they go to this secret canyon, there's this kind of lost city inside it, but it's all in this area, and it includes this guy who's blinded by the Hopi Indians, who's seen the secret cave and stuff like that.
Yeah, Hollywood often touches on these themes. I want to get you back to Tulum. You mentioned it briefly, but isn't it like a walled city with little dollhouses that are only a couple feet high, like everything's in miniature?
Okay, that's a different place. That's Monte Albán, actually, which is in Oaxaca, mm-hmm. which is south of Mexico City. And that has also, and there's a place also in the Yucatan that's like that, that has these miniature people. And that's one of the stories, too. I mean, and I talk about that in all my Lost Cities books, and especially in the Lost Cities of North and Central America, where I talk about giants, and they dig up these giant skeletons and the mounds and things like that, also up in Nevada. But also then you have the little people. And you have these stories of these miniature cities, these small tunnels and things like that go throughout them. I'm right now in Arizona, and here's a popular motif of Cocopelli, who's this small hunchback dwarf, and he plays the flute and things like that. But you have this, and the whole idea that you had whole tribes of kind of miniature people. Many of the islands in the Pacific have this belief, and the Mayans also, which they called they had these special tribes of dwarves and things like that. In Pacific Islands, Hawaii too, they talk about the Manahunis. And oftentimes on Pacific Islands where you have some unexplained megalithic wall, stone statue on Kauai, there are these rock-cut canals and things like that. And they're said to be built by the Manahunis. And the Manahunis are this small, like, pygmy people who live in the forest, and it's throughout Pacific Islands. You hear stories like that, and then people genuinely believe in these small little mini people running around. And, you know, just a couple of years ago, on the island of Flores in Indonesia, it was announced that this was in, you know, all the newspapers and major magazines, how they discovered this entire village of people who were, they called them hobbits and stuff. And there were all these miniature people. And the University of Indonesia got involved in all that. And they even declared, you know, a whole new type of person. And these bones were like 8,000 years ago. So the whole idea of, like, in the past, you know, there were people were giants. They were eight,
hobbits.
Nine people tall. But then there were these miniature people, too.
It's very complex. Now, let me ask you, in all of your travels, you've seen all of these megalithic sites and large stones. Have you seen evidence of advanced machinery or cutting or drilling into these stones?
Oh, yes. And, you know, we are working right now on a documentary about that. If you go to places in Egypt, also in Peru, mm-hmm. you will see places where there's been saw marks, they've been cut. The whole idea of really hard stones being cut, in particularly articulated in really advanced ways. In many cases, and I've taken actually a British engineer named Christopher Dunn, who wrote the Giza Power Plant, with me to some of these locations, and according to him, much of the stonework and cutting would have to be done with machines for the kind of...
Yes.
And even, you know, you get into the whole machine shop thing of where people are grinding out steel blocks into machine parts and things like that. And you can do that, of course, with granite. Basalt is especially hard to work with, but you can see that. I mean, the whole idea of making something with particularly inside corners and things like that, I mean, it's just not easily done by bashing it out with a ball, stone ball in your hand or something like that.
No, I see evidence definitely of advanced machinery. One more place in America, let's talk about the Viking runestones way before Columbus, this incredible giant blocks left behind in Oklahoma.
Well, that's right, and the Hebner runestones there. Yeah, you know, look at the river systems of any continent, and you'll be looking at the ancient highways. Today, much of what we're shown on TV and even what the professors in universities are telling us, I mean, it's unscientific. The idea that oceans are barriers and that people can't get into boats and cross oceans, that you know, coming to North America and South America, everybody has to walk across the Bering Straits and they have to walk everywhere. You know, oceans are barriers. And that's just totally wrong. I mean, oceans are highways. It's the easy way to go somewhere, you know, not to walk through thousands of miles of hostile tribes.
So what did the Vikings leave behind, you think, in Oklahoma? What were these?
Well, they would do is the Vikings were coming in. You have to do, it also has to do with, like, there was less ice, much like what's happening today up in the northern areas. And they were able to come deep into Minnesota, all by boat, into the Great Lakes. They also came up the Mississippi, the Vikings. And this is what people don't quite get. I mean, the Vikings weren't just in Labrador and Newfoundland or something. The Vikings were penetrating deep into America. There's the Spiro Mound, which is also in Oklahoma. Vikings reached all the way to Colorado. Vikings were, you know, in Florida and Texas and stuff like that. Vikings even came up the Rio Grande. Some authors, too, have thought that the famous Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent god, who was supposedly a white bearded god who walked around and also left in boats and things like that. They've identified him with, there were a number of Quetzalcoatls, by the way, and a number of Toltec emperors were also called Quetzalcoatl. But some of these early Quetzalcoatls may well have been Viking explorers and other Viking guys. Also the early Irish saints, like Saint Brendan and stuff like that, and the Irish were coming over here. There was just so much trade, and I mean, and this also has to do with Atlantis and ancient civilizations, and I mean, this is what I maintain in all my books, Lost Cities and Technology of the Gods, and that is that, you know, people just like us who have been just as interested, excited, adventurous, curious. I mean, we've existed on this planet for 50,000 years, 100,000 years, longer. And, you know, there's no reason why we would just sit in our caves for all those years. I mean, we've been out exploring and building cities, building ports, building bridges across rivers, all that kind of stuff. And, I mean, much of these ancient cities are underwater today.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I want to shift gears a little bit. Over the past 5-10 years, there's been so many people reading Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and Da Vinci Code, and looking into this mystery in France. We know there was a priest. He was paid a lot of money by the church. He became a millionaire because he found some documents inside of his church in France. What do you think was in those documents?
Well, you know, the whole thing with the Knights Templar, the Holy Blood, Holy Grail. In fact, I've been to Renzo Chateau a number of times, and I'm going there again in a couple of months. There's another town that's also nearby there called Perillos. and you won't read about that in so many of them. It's actually like a ghost town high in the mountains, and it's near Rennes-le-Château. And they're thinking that that is the original Castle Perilous, which was mentioned in the early Holy Grail documents of searching for the Holy Grail. You had to go to Castle Perilous. And that's actually a town that's there in on the French side of the Pyrenees near Rennes-le-Château. And they believe now, which is a little bit different than most of the books that you've read, although they often focus on something like this, because they know that there's some tombs there. And what everyone's looking for, including Father Saunier of the famous Rennes-le-Château mystery, that in that vicinity was the tomb of Jesus and Mary Magdalene.
Uh-huh.
And the certain treasure was kept there, the Holy Grail, which would, you know, this symbolic cup that was probably an actual relic, was also kept there, and tons of gold as well. And some of that, even the Nazis went looking for that. Much of that whole story was really used as the basis for the Indiana Jones movies, with that treasure and the Holy Grail, and then plus the Spear of Destiny as well. So,
I see. Yeah, it's quite a fascinating mystery. And just a few more questions as we wind down. Do you believe the Great Flood of the Bible actually occurred, and if so, when? Was it before the Egyptian society?
Well, there's been a number of floods, and even the Bible talks about two floods, not just one. Mm-hmm. Ancient Greeks philosophers also talked about a number of floods. So, and that's one reason why I say, too, in my books, that Atlantis is found all over the world, from high in the Andes to underwater and, little islands in Greece, the Sahara Desert, Indonesia. Atlantis has been placed in Sweden and off in the ocean off Holland or between Ireland and England. And that's part of the thing. There's just been many cataclysms. And I would say Noah's Ark and that whole story is certainly one, and probably of a giant tidal wave that wiped out the whole Mediterranean and then blew ships and everything deep, you know, into Asia Minor and to, like, Mount Ararat. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea, too, that there's maybe some giant ancient ship up on the mountains there, Mount Ararat. Yeah, that's quite possible, I think.
Some kind of fossil. Have you seen those pictures?
Well, I have, and I've always been interested in the whole Mount Ararat, and Noah's Ark stuff is pretty interesting to me. I'm not a believer that, you know, the Bible is totally literal, but rather that it's very figurative, and that many things that they talk about in the Bible are true, including the flood.
Yeah.
And I don't think every animal was put in the ark or anything like that.
Maybe the genetics were.
That may well be. And, one of the curious things about the Bible, when you read the Bible like that, and Noah's Ark and the flood is a good story, it's very specific. It talks about, you know, how he built an ark and how big it was, and it was huge. I mean, the Bible's talking about a gigantic ship. There was also a submarine, by the way, and the way he had it made with pitch and stuff like that, it could go underwater. And it was gigantically huge. I mean, it wasn't until modern times, really, that ships that large, as described, were built. But it just shows again that in ancient times, there was stuff like this.
Technology.
They had technology. They built giant ships. They built giant cities with canals. That's part of the story of Atlantis, with all these concentric circles and canals coming into this giant port city. And it was huge. And, you know, just like today, we have airships, we have airports, but we still have giant, you know, container ships. Most traffic between continents is done by ship. It's not done by airliners and things like that. But we have, you know, we have all those things. And I think in ancient times they did, too.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate you coming on. Why don't you just end up by telling us about the World Explorers Club?
We have our magazine called World Explorer and the World Explorers Club. And we're a network of people from all over the world who are interested in the ancient mysteries and all the stuff you hate to talk about on your show. And you can join our club, and basically you get our magazine called World Explorer. It's a color magazine that we send out, and it's all about adventures and megaliths and lost cities and ancient technology. It's a fun magazine. You've seen it, right?
Absolutely, sure. Yeah, I really appreciate you coming on the show. And just everybody go buy David's books. They're at Amazon.com and in all the bookstores, I'm assuming, and pretty well distributed.
Yeah, and check out our own web pages at WexClub.com or at AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com.
Okay, thanks for joining us, David Childress. Good night.
All right, good night, Mike.
Take care.
Bye.
All right, I really appreciate David coming on the show. He's just a wealth of knowledge. And just by the way, he travels around the world sometimes just on back with a backpack, and he hitchhikes. And he gets into some pretty funny predicaments and some pretty close scrapes with death, actually. And he's really an adventurous person. And his books are great travel guides, too. He talks about great hotels to stay at and how to travel real cheaply to all of these third world countries and sites, and gives you this real travelogue and the nitty-gritty. He's definitely a down-to-earth, salt-of-the-earth guy, and it was really a lot of great fun. I really enjoyed talking with David Childress. So that pretty much winds it up. I wanted to spend the whole hour and really get to many, many topics with him. So please check out my website, fountainsofyouth.net, and my DVDs on ancient mysteries, and go to the main webpage, BBS Radio, and click on Odyssey, and find out more about our show. We really love bringing it to you every week. Thanks a lot for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time. Good night.